Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting in the heart of East County. Environmental groups are suing San Diego County over supervisors' approval of the Otay Ranch 14 housing development in Proctor Valley, which plaintiffs say threatens wildlife habitat and residents due to high fire danger. Speaking of fires, we'll also have an update on the Dehesa fire burning near Saquon, and we'll have news about the rescue of a 12-year-old girl from suspected sex traffickers in Spring Valley. Our newsmaker interview today is with Amar Campanajar, the Democrat running for the 50th congressional district seat held by indicted Republican Congressman Duncan Hunter. He'll be sharing his ideas for bringing good-paying jobs to our region, as well as some thoughts on health care reforms, immigration, a green economy, and more. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show, where East County matters.
Last week, San Diego County supervisors approved the controversial Otay Ranch Village 14 master planned community in Proctor Valley near Jamul, which passed by a 3-2 vote. Now, several environmental groups have filed a trio of lawsuits, hoping a judge will cast the deciding vote to block the project based on fire danger to residents and threats to wildlife. Plaintiffs are the Center for Biological Diversity, Endangered Habitat League, Sierra Club, California Chaparral Institute, Preserve Wild Santee, and California Native Plant Society. The group's press release calls the project a sprawl development that will pave over hundreds of acres of habitat for golden eagles and other imperiled wildlife and build new homes in one of California's most dangerously fire-prone areas. Supervisor Diane Jacob and Nathan Fletcher voted against the controversial development, which would build approximately 1,100 new homes and 10,000 square feet of commercial space in the remote, unincorporated area. Jacob stated during the hearing, the threat of fire is real. After Jamul residents raised concerns about the project worsening traffic congestion on Highway 94, supervisors amended the proposal to eliminate access to Highway 94, leaving thousands of residents in the proposed new homes with only one exit route, a two-lane extension of Proctor Valley Road. Those in favor of the project say it's needed to address the region's housing crisis. But with prices expected to start in the $500,000 range, the project would do nothing to fill the need of affordable housing. Proctor Valley is designated as a very high fire hazard severity zone by CAL FIRE and the California Public Utilities Commission, the highest fire risk level in California. The Proctor Valley area has burned at least 17 times in the last 100 years, and the site has burned twice in the last 15 years, including during the Harris Fire in 2007. The project site remains at serious risk for fast-moving, wind-driven fires. The suit contends, according to fire experts, a fire ignited on the project site under Santa Ana winds would likely spread southwest towards population centers at a rate of several miles per hour. That would put homes in Chula Vista at risk, less than 2 miles away. Steep terrain surrounding the project site, covered in chaparral and coastal scrub, would make fire suppression difficult. Thousands of people trying to evacuate on a single two-lane road could result in some becoming trapped, as occurred in the tragic Paradise Fire, where 82 people died. Richard Housley of the Chaparral Institute says, "History has shown that during a wind-driven wildfire, developments like this one in a known fire corridor can and have been destroyed by embers flying a mile or more ahead of the flame front." He adds, "The claim that a development like this is fire-safe ignores everything we have learned during the destructive 2017 and 2018 firestorms." Sierra Club San Diego Chair Peter Anderson says Otay Ranch Village 14 clearly violates a recent court decision that requires in-county mitigation of greenhouse gas emissions, The environmentalists contend that the development would eliminate crucial habitat for the endangered Kino checkerspot butterfly, as well as San Diego fairy shrimp, the California gnatcatcher, and some of the county's last golden eagles, which forage at the site. The lawsuits argue that the project is inconsistent with the county's general plan, and that the project's environmental impact report repeatedly violates the California Environmental Quality Act. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
This is Miriam Raftery with an update on a brush fire burning in the Dehesa area of unincorporated El Cajon. The Dehesa fire started on Sunday at Dehesa Road near Saquon Summit Drive. As of our show taping deadline late Monday afternoon, the fire has burned 150 acres and is now 50% contained, with the forward spread stopped. No structures were burned, although several residents voluntarily evacuated during the blaze, which has sent up smoke visible across most of East County. Firefighters from CAL FIRE, the U.S. Forest Service, Saquon Fire Department, and San Miguel all helped battle the blaze with 17 engines on the scene. Dehesa Road was closed Sunday between Willow Glen Drive and Harbison Canyon Road, but one lane has been reopened for traffic as of now, according to the County Department of Public Works. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Jonathan Getz with the Crime Beat Report. A 12-year-old girl has been rescued from suspected sex traffickers in Spring Valley. Sheriff's detectives from the San Diego Human Trafficking Task Force were investigating a report that the girl, a runaway, was being trafficked. While checking out a location in the 8500 block of Paradise Valley Road on Saturday, detectives found the missing girl. As part of the investigation, two 17-year-old teenage boys were arrested and charged with firearms possession. Sergeant Chase Chiappino says the human trafficking investigation is still being developed and is being handled by the Human Trafficking Task Force. Anyone with information is asked to call Crime Stoppers at 888-580-8477. You can remain anonymous and be eligible for a reward of up to $1,000. You can also download the P3 app to make an anonymous tip from your cell phone.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Tuscansa, recording at our studio in East County. Today, my very special guest is Amar Campanajar. He's the Democratic candidate running for the 50th congressional seat that's currently held by Congressman Duncan Hunter, who's going on trial in September for 60 counts of federal corruption charges. Amar lives in Jamul. He grew up in the San Diego area, where he was raised by his Catholic working-class mother. His first job was as a janitor in a church, where he became a youth leader. He graduated from San Diego State and has worked in the White House and at the U.S. Department of Labor, where he created apprenticeships to train workers and created jobs for those laid off due to trade deals. He's also worked on expanding aid for farm workers, launched summer youth job programs and opportunities for veterans, according to his bio. And he's served as communications and marketing director for the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, helping small businesses. He says his background in helping both business and workers will enable him to make job creation and economic growth among his top policy priorities. He's also a small business owner himself, with a company that helps other small businesses and nonprofits be competitive. And he's an educator lecturing at San Diego State, UCSD, and USD. He's witnessed war and poverty in Gaza, although he was born right here at Grossmont Hospital. And he has a platform that includes reforms to health care, the DREAM Act, investment in renewable energy, and more. And we'll be talking about all those issues and more on today's show. So, Amar, welcome to the East County Magazine radio show.
It's good to be with you again. It's been a long 3 years since we last spoke.
It has. During the primary, the last time you won, when you came within, 4% of...
Yes, 3.4%, but who's counting?
3.4% of beating Congressman Hunter in a
a district that still has a heavily Republican registration. Mm-hmm. So that was really something. The 50th Congressional District includes high rates of rural poverty, as well as low-income areas in some of our East County cities and urban neighborhoods in the San Diego portions of the district. Too often, the efforts to bring good jobs to the San Diego region seem to ignore those communities. You know, we've heard a lot of candidates and some officials make these promises, and it doesn't seem to happen. So, Amar, can you start by giving us some specifics on your ideas to bring good-paying jobs to East County and other parts of this district if you win?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of people make that promise. They're going to create jobs. Is the economy stupid? They always say that, right? Is the economy stupid?
Yeah.
And they make these promises, but I think I'm uniquely positioned given my background as not just a small business owner, but someone who worked at the U.S. Department of Labor working to create good-paying jobs, not just in San Diego County, but throughout the country. And first, let me take a step back and just say there's a couple things that we have to acknowledge. You know, there's a lot of people who talk about these great headlines that GDP is up and unemployment's at a record low and the stock market's doing great. And that's great if you own stock. That's great if, you know, if the GDP matters to you on the macro level. But if unemployment is low because one person is working two to three jobs and barely making a living,
right,
living paycheck to paycheck, talking to me, telling me that they don't know whether or not to decide to get a gallon of gas or a gallon of milk on the way home. These are real stories that I'm hearing in my district. People rationing their pills, rationing their insulin, barely making it, you know, waking up at night not knowing what they're going to do about the next day, whether it's taking care of their kids or how they're going to, you know, just split their lives and split their pills and what bills do they have to maybe forego paying that month? These are the real concerns that we face in our district, especially in rural areas. And I could tell you the good news is that the Department of Labor, when I worked there, my former boss, the Secretary of Labor, partnered with the Secretary of Agriculture, understanding that the rural areas were really, really painfully hit by the economic downturn. The only group that did not get back the jobs that it lost was actually the white working class. And the rural areas tend to be densely populated with white working class folks. So I think one thing we can do, there was a study that showed that really good paying jobs that don't require a college degree in IT, in manufacturing, construction, in financial services, they could be found in rural areas. And the reason is, think about this. Imagine you're a big company and you've been offshoring your jobs for a decade. And you've seen the high costs of gas and oil go up. So it's being more costly to send off, to do your work abroad. And you're realizing the retention rate is lower because of the cultural differences in other countries.
Yeah.
And the customer service isn't as great because there's a language barrier sometimes. All these factors factor in. And we've seen in the last decade, the cost saving of offshoring jobs has gone from 38% down to 27%.
Really?
So we're seeing it decline.
So it's reversing. Mm-hmm. They're starting to come back.
Exactly. And now the onshoring of jobs, businesses are trying to find a place where the retention will be high, meaning people don't move. The cost of living is low. And people have good, fun personalities where they are fun to work with. They have good customer service, good mm-hmm. etiquette. That's rural folks, right? That's people
who
live
in
the rural
areas.
It is.
They're very friendly, and there's a hospitality out there when
exactly.
you go to the rural towns. So.
And the cost of living is lower than the big, densely populated areas.
True. They can't really afford to commute long ways to go to the urban jobs.
Exactly. And the retention rate will be high because people don't leave. We love where we live, right? We try to stay here as long as we
you're
can.
You're a rural resident yourself,
exactly.
so you understand that.
So the way that we could do this is try to provide education, vocational training that's not necessarily college. College isn't for everybody. And I even have Republicans in my district who tell me they don't want their kids to be brainwashed by liberal educators. Mm-hmm. And I take no offense being one of them myself. But, I understand that college isn't for everybody, and there's good things we can do like apprenticeship training.
Yeah, I'm looking at a program, an article here called Rural Means Business, Bringing Tech Jobs to Rural America. And they talk about something called Rural Sourcing, Inc., that's developing IT professionals for clients all over the place and teaching coding and things to do with software and so forth. So is that the kind of thing that you could envision for someplace like Alpine or Ramona or Jamul?
If we could do it in Mississippi, we could do it in Ramona or Jamul or Alpine. And, you know, for example, there's in Kentucky, they have this program called From Coaling to Coding. And I can't think of any more different professions than being a coal miner and then becoming a 21st century coder, going from a blue collar job to a new collar job. And there are many people willing to take that leap of faith and willing to take that responsibility of changing and retooling and retraining if we simply give them the opportunity.
Yeah, and these are good paying jobs.
Great.
We're not talking
jobs.
About bringing a Walmart to town so you can have a minimum wage job and no benefits, right?
Right. The average apprentice makes about $70,000 to $100,000 a year.
Wow.
That's double, if not triple, the median individual income in America and in our district, where the individual income's around, you know, the mid 20,000s, right? 25,000.
I could see that working too for people on some of the Native American reservations out here, where they say the cost of gas, if you're coming from these remote areas, would negate what you would earn on a minimum wage job. So there's really high unemployment out there too.
Yeah. 30% of Native Americans are in poverty.
Right. And they don't all have casinos.
No. And they live off of chips, right? Some of them who are dealers, and that's literally all they could live off of. So one of my big, bold ideas for the 50th, and we talked about this, I think, 3 years ago, and I've been committed to it ever since, and I've been talking to tribal leaders who are interested in this, is, look, California, and now you're going to think I sound like a conservative, but California has been very prohibitive for big corporations because the corporate tax rate is high. And you've seen companies like Toyota leave, and you continue to see that happen because of the tax rate here in California.
Right.
But there are places in California, like the 18 Native American tribes in my district, that have some tax exemptions because they're not technically federal land. They're sovereign nations.
Yes.
So if you were to build a company there, and obviously they're okay with that, building a casino, but if you built a job-creating company, let's say a base for SpaceX, imagine the Cowboys and Aliens scenario in East County.
I love it.
But you create good jobs, you create coders, manufacturers, you create, you know, supply chains to bring food to the location. You create so many different industries if you could just bring this big booming industry, aerospace technology. And the defense contractors would get a slice of the pie too, because instead of using their skills for war, they could use it for peacetime and exploration with SpaceX, because they know how to develop the propulsions and everything that's required. So it's a win-win for small businesses that be part of the supply chain, Native Americans, surrounding residents who don't live in the district, defense contractors. Everybody would win with that kind of scenario, creating good jobs on Native American land.
I'm glad you mentioned small businesses. My next question was, with your leadership background at a chamber of commerce, what do you envision doing to help small businesses, who after all are the backbone of the economy for much of America, and certainly right now here in East County, and yet, as you've mentioned, a lot of them are struggling too with various regulations and so forth, especially in California.
That's a great question. So, you know, for me, we have to just realize, first of all, what the economy is. Two-thirds of all new American jobs are created by small businesses, not these major conglomerates, not the Amazons of the world. And they're good-paying jobs, typically. And what happens is, when a small business owner, an entrepreneur like myself, starts a business and you really invest in your workers, those workers are not just workers. They're what we call intrapreneurs. They're internal entrepreneurs.
Interesting.
And they go on to take their ideas and go on to start their own business, right? That's what happened with me when I worked at the U.S. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. I was invested in, and I became a business owner myself. So first, I think it's important to invest in people who are working. And then the biggest thing that I think a lot of small businesses have a problem with is access to capital, credit, contracts. The federal government's supposed to apportion 21% of all of its federal funds to small businesses, and it doesn't. It doesn't meet that quota, and it usually goes to big conglomerates. So we need to be able to make sure that we're living up to what we know will work for this economy.
You had experience helping minority contractors with the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, and a lot of small businesses get those lucrative federal contracts, I understand.
Yeah, and it's not just federal contracts, but it's also corporate contracts. Like, people, Democrats don't like corporations, but a lot of corporations hire small businesses to work on their supply chain. Like, for example, when we moved the factory, our headquarters of Toyota, from California to Texas, it was a Hispanic business that was working on the contract to build the new headquarters. And that was a lot of wealth for that community. And it didn't just help the Hispanic community. Hispanic business owners, or diverse business owners, if they're in America, they're paying taxes, They're creating jobs. They're providing, you know, services to this very country. So it helps elevate all of us. A rising tide, you know, lifts all boats. And so that's what I learned, is that there's this marriage between big companies and small companies. And I think in this district, what we do lack is, how do you take an idea into a successful venture from concept to completion? You need access to resources. So not just capital, but also access to information.
Correct. And obviously, so, as a congressman, you would be taking that know-how that you gained helping the minority contractors to basically help all the businesses in this district.
Exactly. And I think, you know, when I talk about information, it's access to information through the internet. So one of the things I want to invest in is rural broadband, and make sure everybody in this district has access to high-speed internet, because that's how you take an idea into a, you know, a full fleshed-out business concept that's successful, that's built to last.
Yeah.
And that's a problem that we face in our district.
Access to affordable health care is one of the biggest problems cited by many Americans on both sides of the political aisle. You know, we're hearing more and more from not only the poor, but the middle class getting squeezed on this. I know my own health care policy is like $650 a month and doesn't cover most of the things that I seem to need. Amar, what are your ideas for reforms to bring down health care costs while still assuring access for the middle class and the poor to quality health care?
That's a great question. And probably the most important thing that are in people's minds is the cost of healthcare. Outside of the investment of your home, your health is probably the biggest investment you'll ever make financially. Yeah. And the biggest investment you should be making for your own personal life. Because if you're not healthy, you can't do anything else with your life.
Right.
And I think the pursuit of happiness, it's contingent on your health. So
yeah, and if you're worried about, do I pay the mortgage or the rent, or do I buy a health insurance policy, these are not choices we should be having to make.
Right. And if you're one illness away from losing your home or going bankrupt, or everyone's had that scenario, where my mom's had this scenario where I've been sick and we've debated, do I go to urgent care when I was a child?
Yeah.
But she knew if she walked through those doors, it's going to cost her. And she didn't know if she could afford that.
Yeah. I mean, so, a lot of people, let's face it, there's people that are dying because they can't afford, you know, insulin.
Mm-hmm. And they're rationing their insulin and their pills. And it's just devastating. It's heartbreaking. So the question is, do we believe that we're a nation of broad shoulders and big hearts, that we have the courage and the compassion to give everybody access to healthcare in a way that's financially responsible? And here's the reality. We have universal healthcare in America. It's called the emergency room. Everybody could go to a doctor, but then they'll end up paying an arm and a leg. Taxpayers will end up footing the bill. And I want to make sure we have a healthcare plan where everyone's putting into it and getting out of it what they're putting into it. Right now, we're not seeing that. You have a healthcare plan where, a system in America where one in every five American dollars goes to healthcare. 20% of our healthcare costs go to administrative costs, to give bonuses and these expensive salaries to the executives while the rest of us languish. And that is immoral.
Well, and the drug companies too are making
And the drug companies
profits.
Are even worse. And, you know, you could get a drug, a medication from the same company in the United States, and it will cost a lot. You go to Canada or Mexico or across the pond, the same exact drug from the same company costs less because the United States is subsidizing the rest of the world's pharmaceutical industry and drug and medications. So what we have to do is crack down on them. And what I do with the pharmaceutical aspect is I would have Medicare negotiate prescription drug prices, buy them in bulk, because they have the ability, the government has the ability to buy medication in bulk.
Makes a lot of sense.
And that reduces the cost, because when you buy anything in bulk, right, if you go to Costco and you buy something in bulk, it's cheaper than buying individual pieces. So you do that, and then you allow them to negotiate prices, expanding our markets to well-regulated countries like Canada, so that Americans could purchase medications from other countries that are well-regulated.
So beyond medication, what about all the other aspects of healthcare and insurance for everything else?
Yeah, so 25% of all of our healthcare costs comes from pharmaceutical costs. But the other 75% comes in the fact that we're having to pay these exorbitant premiums, co-payments, deductibles, where people will be insured but underinsured. So that means they have insurance, but they can't pay for their co-pay or deductible. So they never get seen.
Yeah, when you start needing expensive treatments, those deductibles add up.
Exactly. I think what we have to do is preserve the gains that we've made, because now if you have a pre-existing condition, like the 30 million Americans who do, or 100 million actually who do, you still could be seen. That wasn't the case in the past.
Right. The Affordable Care Act, I think that was one of the more popular parts of the Affordable Care Act. Not everybody liked the mandatory, you know, having to buy insurance, but I think everybody, almost everybody, like getting rid of insurance companies being able to throw you off for any kind of pre-existing condition.
And it's ironic because the Affordable Care Act is popular, Obamacare is not, and they're the same thing.
Right, people
but
don't
know that. What's more popular than those two things is Medicare. Mm-hmm. A lot of people like Medicare. When you turn 65 and you retire, you get access to Medicare. And my whole platform is built on this notion that every American should be able to live, work, and retire with dignity. And you can't work with dignity if you are enslaved to a job you hate simply because it's providing you with health care. You should be able to access health care in a way that's affordable to you, that gives you the freedom of choice. So what I would do is, I do believe that we should, I've talked to Republicans, I said, what if we expand, you could buy into Medicare early, right? That's one option.
Mm-hmm.
Like, instead of waiting to retire to get Medicare,
I
what
love
if you
that
had
idea.
It out
I,
there on
I
the
hear
exchanges.
Over and over from people who are between about 50 or 55 and 65. They're getting killed because as we get older, our premiums get jacked up. They know we're a little higher risk of actually having something, you know, go wrong seriously.
Right. So what I would propose is the first thing is allow Medicare to be a public option, right, first.
Mm-hmm.
And I support the idea of in increments of 4 years, expanding Medicare so everyone is eligible for it. So I would start it. I would support a bill that expands Medicare where you buy into it. You don't just simply get it. Nothing's free in this world.
Mm-hmm. And but so if somebody didn't want that for whatever reason, they have something they already like.
They get to keep it. And here's how I see it. Medicare today, it's good. A lot of people like it. The most popular program out there with healthcare. Close to what the VA, it's somewhat not as popular. TRICARE is pretty popular, the military's version of healthcare. These are government-run, you know, healthcares. I'm not proposing government-run healthcare. I think you should be able to see a private doctor.
Yeah, Hunter himself, we should note, gets VA coverage.
Exactly.
So actually, he's getting socialized medicine.
Right, exactly. And we're not proposing that. And I don't think anyone's proposing socialized medicine, to be honest. There's a difference between who's paying for it and who's providing it. There's a very big difference. But what I am proposing is simply you expand Medicare for those who want it in increments of 55, 45, 35, and then everyone else who wants it. And what I think is a couple things. One, people who have Medicare today still get supplemental health care and still get access to private health care if their Medicare doesn't provide all the health care services they need. But Medicare still by itself cannot meet all the health care needs of our seniors.
No.
That's why we have supplemental health care.
Mm-hmm.
So even in this notion of providing Medicare as an option for everybody, or the main option as for the primary health care option, you're still going to need some supplemental healthcare, whether it's cosmetic or more drastic than just cosmetic. There is going to be room for the private insurance companies to play. They will not be playing the way they've been playing by ripping us off, by making huge profits off of our health. It's literally, not figuratively, but literally sickening that we have a healthcare system that's completely privatized where it's built on people being sick. The profit comes from illness. And I think that competition between a public option and a private option, as we move towards full coverage, will create good competition. And I really do believe that Medicare, for as popular as it is between the 65 and up bracket, will be popular for everybody. And you'll see private insurance, just through the free market alone, get phased out. And Medicare for All will end up being a reality that's not imposed on the American people, but will be embraced by the American people out of competition
choice.
And choice. I don't believe in imposing it on anybody, but giving people the choice. And when given the choice, I think they will go into Medicare, and we'll end up with a Medicare for All who wanted option, meaning everybody, I think. So I'd like to note, like, the Senate bill, this is a little wonky. I do not agree with the House version of the bill, which says 2 years for Medicare expansion. I think that's way too aggressive. I support the 4-year expansion. I think that's something that's realistic. And built into that is people being able to buy into it in 4-year increments. I really do believe in choice, and I think there's a sense of urgency of getting it right. But if we are too impractical about how we overhaul healthcare, a lot of people who have healthcare today will lose their healthcare, and people will literally die because we're trying to make the perfect the enemy of the good. So,
yeah, and we don't want to see that. Let's talk about climate change, which worldwide is certainly one of the most important issues facing countries. part of the Democratic platform calls for a Green New Deal, or a lot of leading Democrats are calling for a Green New Deal. Where do you stand on all of that, and how far would you go in terms of trying to move the U.S. toward a clean economy? Yeah. And I might add, you know, balancing the need for clean renewable power to reduce pollution and greenhouse gases against concerns some have about loss of public lands or sort of industrial scale energy projects that, while green, have some impacts, you know, on the land and the communities nearby.
That's a great question. So first of all, I think there's a huge contrast between me and Duncan Hunter on this. He said the Green New Deal is the old socialist steel, which is odd. I'd like to ask him if he thought his TRICARE was socialist, or if the VA is socialist, or Social Security is socialist, or Medicare is socialist. These are social programs. But for me, look, let's be very clear. I think some people scare people about the Green New Deal. The Green New Deal is a non-binding resolution. It's not a legislative proposal. There's no appropriations attached to it. It's literally a non-binding resolution that was proposed by members of the House. That means it has as much teeth as, you know, another non-binding resolution is that the House has said, Congress has said that the Congress has to congratulate whoever wins the Super Bowl. That's a non-binding resolution. And so is the Green New Deal. It's a set of proposals and ideas.
It's like an intent or goals, but not saying that you absolutely have to do
it's
this.
It's an aspiration. And it poses this question: what costs more, doing everything we can to prevent the worst and prepare for the inevitable, the climate crisis we're facing, what costs more, doing everything we can to prevent that, or doing nothing and losing the only planet we all have? And this is real. I mean, the military has said that climate change is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, national security threat to our country.
That's true.
There are 45 U.S.-based military bases that are not able to be fully functional because of droughts, hurricane threats, and on the coast, floods. Right? A rising tide sinks all coasts.
Yeah, the LA Times just had something in the last couple of days about what would happen to the various cities under the current scientific consensus projections that show a rising sea level of anywhere from 3 feet to 9 feet. Mm-hmm. And of course, in California, wildfires.
Yes.
Many of the fire chiefs are attributing the increase in wildfires and the lengthening of wildfire season to basically year-round, largely to climate change.
Right. The weather's changing and climate is changing. That is a reality. It's not just an environmental issue for tree huggers. It's a housing issue for people who lived in homes for 30 years and they lost their home in a fire because the hots are getting hotter and they stand in the middle of rubble acknowledging that climate change is real. It's a healthcare issue for people like my grandmother who had never smoked a day in her life and has emphysema because she worked at a cannery where there wasn't a lot of clean air or clean water.
So what would you do to address the problem?
Yeah, so I think what we need to do, my honest opinion, this is a job creator. It's the mother of all of our problems when it comes to healthcare, environment, when it comes to the military, when it comes to so many things, housing. It could be the mother of all of our solutions too. And it could create so many good paying jobs.
Yeah, putting co-workers
exactly.
to work making solar panels or something.
Right, and helping them transition, not phasing them out, but helping them transition to get good paying jobs. I'll tell you an example. There's a guy that I met. He was in Kentucky when I used to work with the U.S. Department of Labor. Mm-hmm. And he came to our office. He was laid off, and we were giving him trade adjustment assistance, helping him kind of get back on his feet. And he said he worked in different jobs, and he said that, you know, he felt displaced by workers that looked like me. He said, I don't know what it's like. He said, look, Omar, I don't know what it's like. My name's Omar. It's not even Omar. He's like, I don't know what it's like to be an immigrant. I'm not an immigrant. I was born in Grossmont Hospital in 1989. He said, I don't know what it's like to have affirmative action. I never had affirmative action either. He said, but I lost my job to someone who looks like you halfway across the world. And he did a coaling job. He worked in coal, and we put him on this program called From Coaling to Coding. He's making double he's made before, has better benefits, and will probably live longer for his children in healthier conditions and has better benefits too. So that's the kind of ingenuity and reinvention and comeback story that I think is so the hallmark of what America is. So we could create millions of good renewable jobs. And what I want to propose is a World War II mobilization towards combating the climate crisis, because it is the biggest threat we will ever face in the history of this world, of humanity. And when we went to World War II, we mobilized every factory to combat the Nazis, right? So now we have to do the same thing to combat one of the biggest threats we'll ever face, which is climate change. And that's why I think moving towards renewable energy and really investing in this clean, green, new economy is the way of the future. I will say, you talked about the fires being due to climate change. Let's be very clear. Climate change does cause fires, but men do too.
Right.
And SDG&E caused the fire in 07. And they said that they were going to retrofit and take all the poles that are wooden and make them steel. They still haven't done it. On the drive over here, I saw that it wasn't being done still. So that's what's causing a
lot
of these fires.
Some have, but they certainly haven't done them all.
They haven't done them all. And what we should be doing is not converting them to steel, but burying them underground. And while we're doing that, we should be investing in rural broadband. But a big cause of the fires that we've had in the past was this the fire that was started by SDG&E and lack of corporate accountability. And they should be reimbursing all of the victims of that fire.
Do you think that the shareholders, not the ratepayers, should be paying the cost
exactly
of these
right.
fires if they're caused by utility lines?
Exactly. And then we should get rid of the utility lines and bury them underground and get into the 21st century.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I want to mention, this is a big contrast between me and Congressman Duncan Hunter. If you're wondering, what's the difference between me and Congressman Duncan Hunter? There's a lot of differences, but this is one thing. Congressman Duncan Hunter voted for the first version of the tax plan. And that tax plan had relief for people who lose their homes in hurricanes and floods. He voted for that bill, but it did not have relief for people who lose their homes in fires and earthquakes. So Congressman Duncan Hunter was ready to vote for a tax plan he knew was going to hurt California in many ways, including with the state and local tax deductions. That's really hurting a lot of people in this district. This is the difference between me and Congressman Duncan Hunter. He doesn't understand that these wildfires have an impact on American families, on California families, and he's willing to write us off and sell us to the highest bidder. His record shows that. And I don't think that a socialist to say, let's do whatever we can to use America's innovation and entrepreneurial spirit to combat the biggest threat our world will ever face, and that's climate change, and make it a solution and not a problem for ourselves.
A quick question, follow-up question on the climate change. Do you think that there should be more priority given to clean energy solutions that have the least negative impacts on communities and on our public lands and rural lands? For instance, rooftop solar versus, say, an industrial-scale project being built on wetlands or with 500-foot-tall wind turbines next to somebody's house.
Yeah, I do. And I think we should have an all-the-above strategy. What I want to do also is devote all the Department of Energy funds away from, you know, these half-measures of clean coal. And I think we need that's BS. We need to move away from all that and transition fully into all that funding going to molten salt, geothermal, wind turbines for those who want it. There's quieter ones now. We have more technology that's quieter, less invasive, doesn't hurt
the
wildlife
birds,
and birds.
Mm-hmm.
Like my friend Pete Beauregard, who ran against me, he has a really nice double helix wind turbine that birds could spot a mile away.
It doesn't have the sharp blades
that would hurt them. Or solar panels, right? And we should be giving tax credits to, you know, landowners and homeowners who are doing that responsibly, and businesses, by the way. So there's a way we could incentivize moving towards renewable energy. It's not a punishment to businesses or individuals, but it's an incentive. It's an incentivizer for people who want to make sure that we leave behind the only world we have for our children.
You mentioned the fires. The Trump administration has cut federal firefighting budgets and payments to California for firefighting, even as we're battling these increasingly worse fires. Would you go back and be fighting to get more funding? I mean, where is Duncan Hunter on that? I'm not hearing him speaking
out on
his
lack of leadership, it's really just abominable. And on top of that, we are asking our firefighters and our Cal Fire to do so much with so little already.
Yeah.
Especially here in San Diego, we didn't have a countywide fire authority until 2008, after the big fire in 2007, and we're behind.
Right.
We decommissioned it in the 70s, and now we just started again about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, and that's a huge problem. We spend maybe $38 million compared to L.A. County.
That's true.
$100 million.
A county issue, but maybe there's some carrot and stick, you know, approaches to encourage counties like San Diego to do more.
And also, I think, look, California, we pay more in federal taxes than any other state in the union. We need to get out of it what we put into it, and we don't. So we need to see more funds coming in the form of infrastructure reform, more fire relief funding. A whole bunch of investment needs to come back to us.
Infrastructure, like maybe also freeways like Highway 52, where they had all these big housing developments foisted out there and with a promise that there will be a freeway widening. Mm-hmm. And then Sandag is talking about, oh, let's put the money into transit instead, but they're doing nothing about the gridlock that already exists. So maybe getting more federal funding is a solution for that.
Because everyone on the county level is fighting on these county issues, whether it's housing or homelessness or fire prevention or all these things we talked about. A lot of it has to do with the county. And I think the solution comes from people like me going to Congress and fighting for more federal funding for California's 50th, because we're putting into it, into the federal system in the form of taxes we're paying. But we're not getting out of the federal system what we're putting into it.
Very good point. Let's move on from fires to another hot-button issue, which is immigration. Amar, how would you address the immigration and asylum issues that are in all the headlines these days, balancing our national security concerns with America's long-standing reputation as a nation of immigrants? And I'd also like to ask you to address the separation of children from parents at the border and the future of the Dreamers, the children who came here and have been living in America for many, many years, and now a lot of them are fearing deportation as the Trump administration has worked to roll back the DREAM Act protections.
Yeah. First, I think we could secure our country and secure the American dream at the same time. We're America. And America's values, we are a nation of immigrants. Unless you're Native American or you are a slave who was brought here by no choice of your own, we are a nation of immigrants. And this is a phenomenon in America where every new wave of immigrants is hated on by the previous wave of immigrants.
That's true.
So the first thing I would say is the new wave of immigrants, the ones who are struggling right now, do not forget how hard it was. And do not, and break the cycle of hating the next cycle of immigrants. Because one day we will solve this problem with the current wave of immigrants. And then I hope they extend the compassion that our country has not extended to them.
We just had a story that we broke about a new study on immigrants who own businesses. And in California, 25% of the small businesses are owned by immigrants, 10% nationwide. And also some of the biggest and most successful innovative corporations in America were founed either by immigrants or the children of immigrants. That includes Apple and Microsoft and Google and Amazon. Mm-hmm. So where would we be today if those immigrants, if the door had been slammed on those people or their parents?
Nobody would be able to hear our interview, probably.
There you go.
But you know, I worked at the U.S. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, and we worked on a book together with the Bush Institute, a conservative think tank. Mm-hmm. And those were the studies they found, that immigrants are not job takers. They're job creators. 1 in 10 American jobs in this country are created by small immigrant-owned businesses. To your point, they contribute about $1 trillion to the economy every year. So we have to recognize the economic benefits of immigrants. Also understand we're a nation of laws. Asylum seekers are seeking their legal right to come to this country. It is within our laws to accept them unless they pose a threat to this country. Which they don't. Some of them are children who are held, you know, in terrible conditions without food or water or showers or toothpaste for more than 3 days. It's horrific. And it speaks a lot about, this is a where were you moment where the world will look at us and say, where were you when these kids were literally being treated as subhuman? We could have compassion and secure our country. What we need to do is, there's a couple things we need to do is, get more funding so we have more judges to expedite these asylum claims.
True, now, because some may be deported if they were not here legitimately or they were gang members or something.
Number two, conditions at the border are so bad, you have to ask yourself, why the hell are they coming here? What are they fleeing that's so bad? Persecution, execution, economic conditions that are better left imagined than described. And the previous administration invested $750 million to the Northern Triangle, those areas where immigrants are coming from.
Right, Guatemala, Honduras, and
El Salvador.
Yeah.
We need to invest in that Northern Triangle again. And I would say we should double that. Because if you don't want them to come here, we have to set the conditions that are right for them.
Good point. And we're spending the money anyway. We're just spending it on keeping them locked up and in these abusive conditions. So it would be, your argument would be it's better to take that same money
and put it into keeping them where they want to be.
Right.
And then for those who want to contribute to the fullness of America, like we have the world over for time immemorial, the first thing I would do is give Dreamers citizenship. because there are doctors, there are military members, they are small business owners,
yeah.
there are teachers, there are nurses, they are contributing, they know no other country. They were basically Americans except for on paper. Some of them don't even speak the Spanish or the language of their country of origin. They're
right.
so embedded in this culture of America that this is their home. And a lot of conservatives, actually, I've talked to, whether it's at the Turkey Inn in Ramona or somewhere else throughout Jamul, they understand that immigrants are indispensable to our way of life. And yes, there are bad actors. And I tell people all the time, there are, in the immigrant community, there are rapists and killers and drug dealers and gun sellers and all that stuff. But you know who they target the most? Other undocumented immigrants. Because they live among them. And guess what? If you're undocumented and you were raped by another undocumented person, you can't run out in the middle of the street and tell the police because you'll get deported.
Exactly.
And that means,
or if you're a witness to a crime against somebody who is
right.
a citizen.
And then that means that perpetrator gets to go on to the next victim without having said a word because the undocumented immigrant is voiceless in the situation. So I would give status to those who want to contribute. I would make it highly encouraged for them to learn the language. It's just the
sure.
nature of the beast. Anywhere you live in the world, you got to
yeah.
learn the language. And I would also, you know, make sure that they contribute the fullness of this country. But for me, the solution is comprehensive immigration reform. We had this idea, the Gang of Eight bill
yeah.
in the Senate. It's been sitting there for
yeah, and the Gang of Eight was bipartisan, actually,
mm-hmm.
and that seems to have just blown out the window.
Well, we've lost bipartisanship. With the passing of John McCain, the last vestige of any type of bipartisanship has gone with him, and that's what I want to do. I want to bring this country together.
Your opponent, Congressman Hunter, has launched some campaign pieces that have been criticized as racist and Islamophobic, even though you're not Islamic. In the last election, he accused you of having ties to terrorists because of a Palestinian grandfather who died before you were born, who some reports indicate may have been involved in the Munich Olympics attacks, although there's some question about that. In any case, you've denounced terrorism quite forcefully, been endorsed by rabbis, you're not Muslim, and you attend a local church, which the Hunter campaign is well aware of. And yet his most recent mailer, just sent in July, has a photo of a masked terrorist at the Munich Olympics on one side, and on the other are photos of you juxtaposed against photos of two Muslim congresswomen, and a message that states these three radical Democrats want you to forget their anti-Semitism or family terrorist ties. I would like to give you an opportunity to respond to that and also to ask, do you see a connection between Hunter's tactics and what we're seeing at the presidential level? As we're taping this, we've just had Congress pass a resolution condemning President Trump for tweets encouraging four women of color in Congress, including two shown on this flyer, by the way, to go home, even though three of them actually are citizens who were born here.
That's a big question, but I will say that I don't like fanning the flames. I don't like dignifying this stuff with an answer, and I'll tell you why. The people in the district don't care about this stuff. They don't buy it. I'll tell you how I know. I talk to voters all the time who tell me, I just want you to put country over party, get rid of the chaos. Don't make this be a race to the bottom. Rise to the top. Raise the bar. And NBC Local, Channel 7, did a story on this just yesterday where they went talking to people and they were like, yeah, we don't believe these lies. So
I saw that. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, I don't think voters believe it. So I'm not going to take the bait because he wants to keep this race not about the issues but about identity politics. And you'll remember Republicans used to be the ones who used to hate identity politics. Now people like Hunter are embracing that. And that's why a lot of Republicans are leaving the party, running independent or being independent, because they're fed up with the identity politics that's plaguing this country. And our nation, we're this nation that was built on the notion of every nation being welcome here. And that notion of e pluribus unum, out of many, one. Our founders, their wisdom was ahead of their time because they didn't know what the many would look like and how many we would be. They would never know we'd be 340 million people. They wouldn't know we'd be from every single place on the planet. They didn't know that, but they knew that, you know, we were going to be the one truly indispensable nation in the world, a beacon of hope that welcomed everyone and left nobody behind. So I think we have to get rid of this negativity. I tell people, look, there is this quote that I love, and it always means something different to me when I read it, but there's a quote by this poet. He says, we're all just walking each other home. And I thought about that when I heard Trump say to some of these members, go home. And a part of me thought, you know, God, we've gone so far away from who we are as a country. We've lost our sense of self. We're not living up to like our best selves and our highest ideals. And it's heartbreaking because I think we all love this country. And I think we're so distracted with the constant tweeting and the chaos. And even Trump voters don't like Trump's tweeting. But voters in this district don't like the tweeting, don't like the divisiveness. Just be a businessman, don't be a showman, and bring this country together. America needs to be healed again. And we need to know who we are. We're one nation, we're one people. And I think we have to walk back all this stuff and walk each other back home to the America that we've always loved but lost over the past 3 years.
Congressman Hunter is slated to go on trial in September. He's accused of stealing $250,000 from his campaign and spending it on a lavish personal lifestyle, including family trips overseas and even overnight trips with mistresses. His wife has pled guilty to one count and is cooperating with the prosecutors. Now, Hunter has said that he has no plans to resign. But, of course, if he decides to cut a settlement deal with the prosecutors or if he's convicted, he might change his mind, or the party, for that matter, might pressure him to step down. And that could trigger a special election. So, Amar, I'd like to ask, how prepared are you financially and in other ways to take on any of the several Republicans who are saying that they would run for the seat, especially if Hunter were to resign?
I'm ready. I'm the only guy running who almost beat Hunter. I got 48.3%. I have the backing of almost half the district. We are going to finish stronger by starting stronger. I started earlier this cycle than I did last cycle. I announced, I think, in April or March last cycle. I announced January 1st, literally after New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
I kissed my girlfriend, and then I announced I was running for Congress. So that's
you've been all over the district, too, meeting and talking to people.
I've been going to every single part of this district, talking to people at VFWs and senior centers. People know me, and I know them. When I know someone, if a business shuts down, I know them by name now. And when someone's going through a hard time, I send them a get well note. I know who they are. I've touched their lives. They've touched my life. We have the campaign war chest. We have more in the bank than Hunter has by 4-1.
You got a town hall coming up,
We have a town hall in Alpine coming up on August 18th. And we're excited about that. And I know that everywhere we went, even in Santee, where people thought we had no chance, everywhere we went, we won. We got 48.3%. We're going to finish stronger by starting stronger. And there's nobody who is running who could say they've been committed 100%, not part-time, but 100% towards investing and caring for this district. I've been a small business owner. I've been teaching on the side. But my number one priority for the past 3 years has been what keeps people up at night, what gets them going in the morning in the 50th district. And I challenge anyone. I got holes on the shoes that I'm wearing right now because I canvass.
He does.
And I talk to people all the time. And it's a full-time gig for me. It's one that I think if I'm humbled to serve, I will execute with a lot more dignity than our current occupant does.
Now, speaking of the current occupant, Congressman Hunter is a military veteran, of course, Iraq and Afghanistan, and he serves on the Armed Services Committee. What are your ideas for helping the members of our military and veterans if you're elected?
That's a great question. So look, I do not always support the mission. I did not support the idea of us going to Iraq. It'd be a huge mistake to go into Iran, especially isolated without the international community. We cannot go at it alone. But I don't always support the mission, but I always support the troops. And I think by supporting the troops, when you support the military, you support the people that serve with them, their military families. That's not me taking a punch at Hunter's personal life at all. I mean that sincerely about, you know, families serve alongside our military men and women, and making sure that they have the ability to live, work, and retire with dignity themselves, their spouses and their kids have access to services. So making sure we're making smart investments in the lives of those who serve along our men and women, and also making sure that we're not just haphazardly sending our young men and women into wars just to profit the military-industrial complex. That is a problem. And then also, this is super important, you're not dispensable the moment you leave the military. When you become a veteran, you're still somebody who has a life. And I think that our goal for our military is when you leave, that your lifespan outside the military is longer and more enjoyable than your time in military. You shouldn't be just, well, here's a stress ball, here's some pills, here's a shirt, and God bless you.
So we should be doing a better job of taking care of our veterans and helping them get jobs.
Vocational training, wraparound services, mental health, housing. And they served us. The least we can do is try to settle that debt and give them, you know, give them the service that they gave us and sacrifice this country. And someone who agrees with me is actually someone that I have so much respect for. His name is Joseph Riley. He was a paratrooper in World War II from Santee.
Yes.
And he was honored by Donald Trump at the State of the Union. He was one of the four there.
He was at D-Day, wasn't he?
The D-Day
75th anniversary.
And he was sitting next to one of the, Joseph Riley, who was honored by Donald Trump, is saying that Hunter has been dishonorable. Actually, the Marine Corps filed a cease and desist against Duncan Hunter for using his mailers and using the Marine Corps insignia, a symbol. So his ethics, symbolically, in word and in deed, he does not represent the nobility and the code of conduct that our military is known for across the world. We lead not just by the example of our power, but by the power of our example. And Congressman Hunter, as an individual, doesn't lead by the power of his example. And I think our military needs to do that. So we need people in Congress who could make sure that the military is well-funded, but not overfunded. The military, you know, the Pentagon asked for less funding than the administration gave them. And that's going towards the profiteers of war.
Yeah.
Sending our troops into harm's way just to profit, and that's wrong.
Listeners, if you just tuned in, we are speaking with Amar Kampanijar, the Democratic candidate running for the 50th Congressional District, currently held by Congressman Duncan Hunter. Amar, I'm going to give you the last word today. What else would you like our listeners to know about that we haven't already addressed today?
I just want people to know that I don't look at this race. I don't look at it as me being a Democrat or a Republican. I'm an American. I was born here. I love my district. I don't look at the issues as leftist issues or right issues. I think it's a showdown between those who are in power on the inside of Washington and those of us who've been disempowered on the outside. And whether, you know, when you look at the economy, it's not working for us. It's not working for working people. You know, we have two or three jobs. That's why the unemployment rate is going down. The financial industry is doing great for Wall Street, but not great for the rest of us. Healthcare is great if you're a CEO of a healthcare company, but not if you're splitting your pills like grandma is, or rationing your insulin like your aunt is or you are. It's not working well for so many people. The fossil fuel industry is doing great for, you know, for them, and SDG&E is doing great, having great profits. But what about the rest of us who are seeing record level heat waves and fires and droughts in our district? It's not helping the rest of us. So we need an economy and a government that works for working people. I've spent my whole life, whether it was a janitor at my church or working in our government, or being a small business owner or educating, I spent my whole life committed to service, and I hope I could serve this district and turn this chapter of corruption and bring accountability to Washington. And if you give me a chance and you be my voice this election, I will be your voice in Congress.
Thank you very much, Amar, for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Royalty Free Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.